So that's just a sexual attraction, but it's not really caring or affection.
Right, that's right. And in fact, they don't want to. They do a number of things, even if they have a you know, what looks to us like a long-term relationship.
So in this case, it's probably really more of an attachment to the act of sexual intercourse than it is attachment to the actual other person.
Right, and the thing that I want to focus on here, just because it's all that matters for these studies, even though sex is one of the things that we're studying, I deliberately left it out all the way through. But another, just to give you, again, to give you an idea of these people's minds, if the person is in a long-term relationship but has this kind of avoidant orientation, and many of them in college are in a long-term relationship, they are more likely to say that while they're having sex with their partner, they're imagining it's someone else. You know, things like that. And they're going around, look, they're open to sexual relationship with other people, other people's partners. So the thing that interests me about it is that the discomfort with intimacy carries across all of their relationships.
And I heard his own statement a little bit differently than the earlier translation, so please do correct me if I'm wrong. But what I heard was, when his own said, when there is this kind of romantic or sexual attachment, or let's call it love now, sexual love, that is often, we speak of love-hate relationships. Uh-huh. So you're kind of sexually drawn to a person, but then there's kind of a love-hate, and kind of like an alloy, like an oscillation, and it seems to be really like a package. That seems to be quite common on the one hand. On the other hand, when there's really compassion, it doesn't seem like compassion is something that works together with hatred. I really feel compassion for you, but I hate you, I love compassion.
Right.
It seems like compassion is really more, it's just compassion, and not a close kin to hatred or anger.
If I could just jump in for one sec, and we can talk about it more this afternoon, but there are data to suggest that sexual attraction involves different brain regions than caring or compassion, per se.
This is why I was saying these kind of relationships often begin with sexual attraction as a factor, but then once the people are relating to each other, all these issues come up. I agree completely. I think that sex is just one of many ways to draw the people into a relationship, and then you see these patterns in their relationship. But it's not about sex per se, although it shows up there too. It's that once they're in a close relationship with someone, all these close relationship issues come up. The thing you were saying, Alan, too, just so you get the idea, the secure people have relationships more of this kind without this. This description of love-hate is an anxious person's relationship. And it sometimes leads to violence. They break up more often and get back together with the same person. This, too, goes with this idea of grasping being danger, you know, if it's sort of I'm trying to coerce you into doing something that, you know, that probably can't be done by anyone in the short run.
Saying, would you expect a higher rate of divorce for these?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for both insecure ones, it's higher. So these longitudinal studies show both that there is some consistency, that if we study those one-year-old children over time, and there are studies now that go 20 years, over time there's a tendency for them to be the same. But at the same time, it's very clear that it can change. And we can even see some specific examples of why it changes. If an insecure child finds a good parent, in effect, through whatever means, another relative comes in as a major person, an important teacher, an older sibling, you know, they can sometimes recover. And on the other side of it, divorce, you know, watching parental violence, those kinds of things, disruption of a previously good situation can make the child more insecure. So basically, all I wanted to conclude about these longitudinal studies is there's evidence for stability and change. They're both important. We wouldn't study these patterns if they didn't have some stability, but it's also possible to change. There are hundreds of studies now, including a lot of them by us. We have a reading list, by the way, of our references if somebody really wants to know about the studies. And these are some of the issues. I'm not going to go into what we find, but we've studied marital couples' communication and the quality of marriages. We've studied the psychology of these different kinds of people, finding that the secure ones are more open to new information, even that's threatening. They change their beliefs, you know, they're sort of open to change. There are issues of performance in groups and organizations. That's why I know it's not just about like a romantic relationship or any particular kind of relationship. The same issues show up at the workplace, in schools, and things like that. Then I'll just say something about one of these, then we can take a tea break. The one that says experience and management of death anxiety. Mario and his colleagues did an interesting study looking at death anxiety measured consciously, you know, a questionnaire, sort of how are you, how much afraid of death, and then unconsciously or indirectly by having people tell stories about pictures and then checking them for signs of death anxiety. And even there, what you see is the anxious people are afraid of death, you know, which would be like nothing to hang on to maybe, consciously and unconsciously. The avoidant people are afraid of it unconsciously, but say they're not at the level of consciousness. And the secure ones seem not to be very afraid of it consciously or unconsciously. The secure ones have constructive defenses that they're interested in. One is seeing themselves as having greater symbolic immortality, that their works will continue on, their children, you know, they see themselves as continuing in a good way. So they protect themselves to the extent they do against death in sort of a positive way. I'm going to follow this model. No shoes. A new fashion.
More comfortable.
For
me. More comfortable.
One other thing I wanted to say to you personally is just that it was amazing to me to see your effect on Paul Ekman. I said, it's amazing for me to see your good effects on Paul Ekman. When he came back to the United States after being to this other Mind and Life conference and showed the videotape and almost cried. And that's a guy who's
hypnotized him.
He's always wondering whether he hypnotized him.
Yeah, it could be. He changed his research project to the Cultivating Emotional Balance project. It changed his life, and he's not an easy guy to change. So. Yeah, exactly.
One of my agendas is to bring great scientists here because they go back.
Yeah, that's right. He takes all of us mean ones and brings it here and turns us into nice. Yeah. Right. Okay, well, I've removed half of the remaining slides, so I'll try. I want to show you a couple of things experimental so you get an idea of what we do. This is the attachment theory says that if you could threaten or frighten a person momentarily, you should see these attachment systems come online in the mind. Okay, so that's what I'm interested in now. We, as a way of measuring that the attachment system has been turned on in the brain, we have two ways that I'm showing here. One would be to show that concepts in the mind like love, hug, and in the case of insecure people, as you'll see, rejection, abandonment, and things like that, will become more available neurologically. And the second one is that if the theory is right that when you're threatened, your mind turns for refuge or help to these people that you can rely on, their names should become more available in your mind. And both of them is true, but to find that out. So we did a series of experiments in a laboratory. I'll show you what it looks like in a minute. And what we try to do is, without the person knowing it, show them a threatening word very, very quickly so that it enters their mind but not consciously. And the words are words like death, illness, failure, separation, things like that. And to measure to see what became active in their mind, they do something called a lexical decision task. And I'll show you what that means, but it means, they decide whether something's a word or not. And we have different kinds of target words that they're saying this is a word or it's not. Of these five kinds, ones that are emotionally positive and related to attachment, like love and hug, or negative and related to attachment, like rejection and loss. And then as control conditions in the experiment, we have positive words that are not related closely to attachment, like success, win, and things like that. Negative and not related directly to attachment, weak and thief. And then some neutral word, table, chair, and things like that. And I need to explain this just briefly, too. We in the case of the avoidant person, we know that in some of our other experiments, they are so well trained to suppress things that are troubling that they might look like the secure ones. And so we want to interfere with the frontal lobe processes that are causing the suppression. I hope I can make it clear in a minute. The way we do that is simply have them do another mental task, remembering a 7-digit number, just an arbitrary number. But there's a number, and they say, now you have to remember that. That's going to take up some attention and rehearsing that number, and you'll see it's enough to allow the insecure parts of their mind to show when they don't show if they have full control. And what we measure at the end, the dependent variable in the experiment, is how long it takes them to decide that this is a word instead of a non-word. Yes, and to say yes, it's a word or it's not. And one thing I think I haven't made clear yet, and that is the idea, and this has been well demonstrated in cognitive psychology experiments, if the subliminal presentation of the word death, say, is threatening, and that activates these attachment-related memory circuits, they'll be faster at seeing that an attachment-related word is a word, because part of it is already active in
them. How do you do the subliminal? It's basically a very fast rate.
Yes, you're going to see. I'm going to show you. Okay, so the person in the experiment sits at a computer like this one and sees on the screen an X, and we tell them to focus their attention on that X. And that X is on 500 milliseconds, is a half of a second. So, less than just a little, but enough for them to focus. And then, this is the tricky part, faster than they can see, 22,000 of a second, this threatening word appears, and they don't see it consciously. And because if we didn't do something to stop the stimulation at the retina...
22 milliseconds would be... What would be the percentage of a second? 22 milliseconds?
Yeah.
Tenth of a blink.
And the way the visual system works, if we presented the word death for 22 thousandths of a second and then did nothing else for a while, the person might still see it because it stays on the retina and things like that. So we have to put what's called a mask over it immediately. So the word death appears, and then after 22 thousandths of a second, a bunch of X's appear just to block that out at the retina. And then we know from a lot of experiments the person won't be aware of any of that. I'm going to show it to you a little slower than we really do, so you will briefly see it. But the mask is just to end the stimulation here so we know the timing is really 22 thousandths of a second. And then the person didn't see death, even though it occurred. Then a word comes on the screen, and the person pushes a button to say, love is a word or it's not. And the ones that are not are scrambled words, like down at the bottom. So it's like love with its letters. If it said those scrambled letters, they'd say, no, it's not a word. If it is a word, they say, yes, it's a word. So here's the way it looks. I'm showing it to you slowly. So if you look really, okay, now look at the X. So you saw it would go much faster than that, and the person would have no awareness of it at all. And yet it affects what becomes available. So when you do that with a group of people, they show, when it's a threatening word, they show faster ability to say that love, hug, close, and those kinds of attachment words are words. And if you put a word, instead of death, you put table, subconsciously, it does not have that effect. So it shows that the way the mind is built to turn on issues related to love. So that's sort of a general effect, but there are individual differences in the experiment related to the measures that I showed you before the tea break. The people who are secure automatically activate only those positive things about attachment, and the anxious ones activate those plus rejection, loss, lonely, abandoned, you know, and things like that. So it's like when they go to the place in their mind that's about their wish for security, the negative things are wrapped all around that with the positive ones. So then the third, this avoidant pattern, shows activation of the positive ones, so they look like the secure people, unless they're in the condition with the cognitive load added that takes up some of their mental capacities, and then the negative ones come on automatically too, indicating that they must be going around all the time with an inhibitory, an effortful inhibition of the negative side of this so that they don't experience it consciously.
I'm just wondering, and it's also, His Holiness also concurs that whether there will be a difference for, say, for example, individuals, and which is quite typical for Buddhist practitioners, to set a kind of a certain motivation at the beginning of the day, kind of a prepare oneself. And if one does that, would you expect to see a difference in the experimental?
Richie and I were saying maybe another possible topic for this afternoon is real experiments we could do using these Buddhist methods, because we have the technology to see whether some kind of practice has, you know, these effects, including, as I'll show you, at least in a kind of laboratory way, whether it affects compassion, helping, things like that. So I'm skipping over now other studies like that. So basically, we know a bunch of things about threat activates, does activate the attachment figure's names, too. So on comes another, just as an aside, something that interests me is this, I take refuge in the Buddha. I think the Buddha would be one, for Buddha's, however, you know, the Tibetan word for it, and it's very testable. So now what I really wanted to get to, thank goodness I'm getting to, that is, having done a lot of those experiments where we're threatening the person, we then wanted to see, could we do something on the positive side in the same kind of way, but enhance the person's sense of security and then see good effects. And the theory, remember, says if you could down-regulate the attachment orientation by making the person more secure, then caregiving, compassion, things would be easier to come on. So the first set of studies that we published about this, done in Mario's lab in Israel, has to do with intergroup tolerance. And in the context of Israel, the theory suggests that if you could make a person more secure, they would be more open to dealings with other ethnic groups and things like that because they feel less threatened. And we knew from child development studies that this was true in the sense that these secure children show greater openness to new information and everything, and we have some information like that about adults. So that in the children, it makes them more curious and less afraid of strangers. If you think of an out-group member as sort of a threatening stranger, the same thing might be true in adults. And our idea was that if everyone has this attachment system, even if they've distorted it somewhat by insecurity, if you could put in this message of security, it might have a good effect on everyone. So another question is whether it has a good effect despite the individual differences that I was talking about before. So five experiments were done in Israel, and they, in the different experiments, we used different methods of making them feel more secure, sometimes unconscious, like there's a thing here. It could be words like love, hug, and secure. In subsequent studies, we've used the names of their close attachment figures. And in some of the experiments, it was done consciously, which would be more, I think, like a meditation practice, where, for example, the person imagines someone treating them very well, taking care of them and things like that, whatever that means to them, to focus on that for a while in a guided imagery task. The reason we need the unconscious one, too, to be convincing is that if we did a social psychology experiment and said, we talk to the people about being nice, then we ask them if they're nice, everyone would think that it's just, we're asking them to do that. When the security stimulus comes in unconsciously, they don't know we've done this to them. And so then if it has that good effect, it rules out one easy explanation of the results. Across these five experiments, we also had different outgroups, as they're called in social psychology, that we're talking about. The participants in the experiment, the people the experiment is being done on, are Jewish students at a university in Israel. And so the groups, Arabs, ultra-Orthodox Jews, like the person who shot Yitzhak Rabin, Russian immigrants and homosexuals. Other research had shown that these Israeli students, on average, are prejudiced about those groups. And so they are good targets for us to try to make them more compassionate towards. So in the experiments, the participant thought that they have an opportunity to interact with someone, and they'd read some written materials by this person. They're kind of like an application to the university. So it has a little essay in it, and it tells their name, where they came from, and everything, and that the things they say either in their written essay or their names identify them as being from one of these out-groups or from the in-group. So what happens? In all five experiments, the presentation, subliminal or conscious, either one seems to work the same way, caused them to be more tolerant toward this person from the out-group, more willing to interact with them. They like the sound of them better and things like that in a statistically significant way. And in some of the experiments later in the series, we made it harder for them to be nice by having the person say in their essay that they didn't like these kind of people, the participants. So there's something to you know, be defensive about that might make them angry. And even under those conditions, the security, increased sense of security, made them actually no different to an out-group or an in-group member. There's always an in-group control condition. And the second point up there, we had other conditions to see if success, for example, a positive word instead of love, hug, and those things would have the same effect, and it does not. So it's not just positive emotion. It has something to do with love.
Someone's wondering because this is because the affection. I was wondering whether, to some extent, you know, sense of well-being or happiness and joy, and these are kind of slightly more higher cognitive kind of differentiation, whereas love and affection is so primary and so fundamental that appreciation of that is so crucial to the child at such an early age. He's always wondering whether this is the reason or...
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know, to make the long story short, but theoretically, if I take refuge in the theory... theoretically, there's a kind of... this reciprocal relationship, I was saying, between attachment security and the other behavioral systems being active. And happiness, this word success, you know, is in the achievement domain. So its associations can be about competition, winning, beating someone else, all of that. So I think that it's something like that, that the attachment one touches on a kind of comfort that then makes tolerance for others more available. But it really... These are some of the issues that so close to issues in Buddhist psychology that I think it would be great to try to figure it out. And some of it might be testable, and there might be more sophisticated ideas. Another hint about this I should mention, because I think it's similar to this idea of grasping, is that the people who scored higher on the anxious dimension, our questionnaire beforehand, so an individual difference, the more anxious ones saw those outgroups as more threatening. So another part of the mystery is that people who don't feel secure in the sense of being loved and protected are more threatened by these, you know, people who are different and things like that. So it's another sign that it's part of this attachment. The final point here related to what I was saying we were interested in the study is that good effect of increasing a sense of security occurred for people, whether they're secure or not, on that individual differences measure. So the good effect of security is available to the insecure people. So now another, having gone that far, we wanted to move a little bit more toward the area that, first of all, that compassion, being a Buddhist concept, makes it interesting. And also, as I'm sure you know, Daniel Batson had done empathy studies. So we use some of his measures here. So here the question is going to be, can we make a person feel more secure, and then they will experience more compassion and be more helpful? Okay? So it takes me a little bit to explain this. And again, the idea in the theory is that a secure person has this caregiving system more available for use. They're less concerned about protecting themselves. And again, there were hints in the child development literature that attachment security is related to empathy, even in three-year-olds. If you bring in a clown, there's an experiment that's done, and the clown, something happens to them, they start crying. The children who were more secure at one-year-old in that strain situation test are going over to the crying clown and trying to help them. Before doing experiments about this where we try to affect it, we did some questionnaire studies in the United States and the Netherlands and Israel to see if just normally out in the world are more secure people volunteering to help others more, give blood, deliver food to sick people, and that kind of thing. And we also wanted to know, if they're doing those kind of things, why are they doing them? What are their motives? And one of the things we found, and this is in more studies than I'm talking about here, the more avoidant they are in that avoidance scale, which was, you know, about not wanting to be close to relationship partners, not really about any like community helping per se, the more avoidant they are, the less they volunteer to help others. And if they are involved in some kind of helping activity, they have less other-oriented altruistic reasons. There are other kinds of reasons you could be doing this, like to get credits for medical school or, you know, something like that. The more anxious people on the anxious scale that I was talking about don't volunteer more or less than secure people, but the reasons they have for volunteering are self-focused in the sense, as I put here as examples, to feel included, not to be as lonely. You know, it's, again, all about me. It's sort of, I'll help you because then you'll thank me, something like that. And so that's interesting, too. And I haven't been laying heavily on this, but for my scientific colleagues, in all of these studies, we have alternative explanations like self-esteem and everything that don't explain the results. So far, we don't find an alternative construct to attachment that explains it. So then we decided to do this experimentally. Can we affect their level of compassion and empathy and altruism? And in one of the experiments I'm going to tell you about, we used a subliminal priming method again, unconscious. We did the same study again with a conscious security induction. And we did the same studies in Israel and the United States so we could see if it's cross nationally generalizable, at least in those kind of societies. So the way this study goes, it would take too long to describe in a lot of detail, but a person comes into an experiment at the university. They believe another person has come in another room. They're connected by a video intercom. So if I'm the participant, I look on a screen here and I see you in another room. And I think the study is about you're going to be doing some aversive tasks that are probably going to make you emotional and uncomfortable and things. And my job is to watch you. And we're going to check once in a while, see how am I feeling about watching you suffer. And in fact, that other person is a videotaped actress who seems to them like another subject. That's so that this videotaped actress can speak English and Hebrew. So the videotape could be made as much the same as possible in the United States and Israel. And also, it's then the same for every participant in the study. We don't have to have an actress do something every time we run somebody. The stimulus is always the same. So right before doing this, these real participants are exposed to, you know, a subliminal security induction or some control condition. So we can see if them being more secure affects the way they react to watching this person. And I have to tell you a little bit about what the woman in the film is doing. She's going through a set of tasks, and the first one is to look at some gory accident photos that are used in emotion research all the time. People with their intestines falling out after an accident and stuff like that. So there, we know people look at these and they don't find it pleasant. So this actress looks at these and clearly doesn't like doing it, but she's able to do it.
So the subjects are not aware that the video is being played.
No. They think it's a real person that they're watching on the screen, yeah. And so this actor is already a little uncomfortable. Now the next task. Another task is one that's actually used in study sometimes. The actress has to put her arm in a bucket of ice, and that is in real life is painful. And for this actress, that actually was the most difficult thing to do because it really hurt. And then to get to the most important part, about the fifth step of this series of tasks, it is to pet a live tarantula, a hairy spider, in a glass open-top glass aquarium, and it was a real tarantula. So by that time, the actress is saying, "No, this I don't think I can do," you know, like this. And so the experimenter stops the thing and says, "You know, we're going to see if she can go on," and things like that. And at that point, the participant who's been watching this is asked to say how they feel in watching her. Do they feel compassionate, sympathetic, and things like that? How much do they feel that on a numbered scale? How personally distressed do they feel? That's our attempt to measure this. It's bothering me, but not necessarily that I'm compassionate. It just makes me feel bad to watch it. And that's Batson called that personal distress. We measured it with words like alarmed, distressed. We asked them just in a verbal way, how do they feel about helping her by replacing her? And then the final, most important thing is, will they replace her? The study can't go on unless somebody is, you know, petting the tarantula and going on. The next one is going to be cockroaches running up your arm. They think that's what's going to happen.
So I was wondering why cockroaches. We did a pilot study. Because the reason why someone is asking is India is full of it.
I think students at our university would not want to sleep in those hotels. So we wanted the person to feel if they're going to replace her so that she can stop suffering, it's going to be at some cost to themselves. They're going to have to do something they don't like. At the level of those self-reports on Batson's scale, this yellow line here represents the ones who got this security prime unconsciously before they began that study. They're significantly more compassionate by their rating. They feel inclined to help on this scaled measure. And on the behavioral measure, it looks like this. There many more of them are willing to take her place and let her relax and get out of that situation. So this makes it seem that you can make the person feel more secure, and then they really have a greater capacity to both feel for someone that's suffering and have an effective response to it. The same thing, I won't go through the details.
I'm just out of curiosity, for the clarity's sake. Yep. When you say the willingness, the inclination, or the willingness to take the other person's place, do you measure it at the conscious level, or is it biologically measured?
Yeah, at the conscious level. They actually are, at that last one, the behavioral one, they're saying, okay, I unhook myself here and I'll go over in the room with the tarantula and it'll be me instead of her. So the second experiment using a conscious method of inducing security, which was think about being comforted by someone who loves them, things like that, had the same kind of effects. And in addition to the experimental effects, the more avoidant people were on our scale before the study began, the less compassionate they felt and the less willing they were to help. The more anxious people were on the anxious attachment dimension, the more personally distressed. So it's alarming and distressing to me to see this going on, but they don't help more. And that, I think that's really important. And the final thing is that, again, that making the person feel more secure had this good effect, independent of their avoidance or anxiety in this dispositional sense. I mean, it works on all, everyone. Again, suggesting that the whole attachment system is there to be helped, you know, if you can get to it, regardless of what the person is usually doing about these kind of things. So I just skipped over some. We did similar studies to see the sense of gratitude and sort of the way the person experienced gratitude. We did it for forgiveness and the same kinds of things. Interesting details, but I skip over it in to show you this. Having seen that we can do this, that we can get all these good effects of a fairly minor increase in security, Mario then did some interesting studies, and I just want to suggest to you and the audience that that this kind of thing might have a clinical application. So this is a study about post-traumatic stress in, of Israelis related to Palestinian terrorists in the occupied territories. So that's the issue, the people's responses to terrorist traumas. And people were asked about the their degree of distress and the kinds of symptoms they have about this using questionnaire measures. And their implicit, their kind of automatic reaction to terrorist issues like Hamas, that word, and things like that, car bomb, and things you'll see in a second. The way we measure how bothered they are, sort of how powerful that issue is in their mind, in this case, is called the Stroop color naming test. And I'll show you in a second what it means. But basically, the participant in the study is seeing words on a screen, and they're printed in colors. And what they have to do is say what color it's printed in, without being slowed down by the fact that it says car bomb. And that's been shown to be a good way of finding out.
I was just reminding His Holiness that we had a demonstration of the Stroop test at MIT. Good. There was a green color.
Yeah.
The word green was written in red.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, that's very extreme because you have to suppress the meaning of the word and just look at the ink, and both of them are colors. And you can do the same thing with this. Anything that's prominent in the person's mind will make it harder to name the color because it comes out and grabs your attention.
It's quite quite strange.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the participants in this study were 120 Israeli students. They are Jews. And they took our attachment measure in Hebrew. In Mario's lab, everything is translated to Hebrew. And they took this PTSD symptoms inventory, and they were divided into two groups for further study based on high score or low score on PTSD symptoms, these reactions to terrorism. And so 2 to 3 weeks after that assessment, they came to the lab, and they did a Stroop test that had different kinds of words. And those are they're examples of 10 terror-related words that like that, so except they were in Hebrew. And those things are, the more the person is traumatized, the longer it takes them to name the color, because what stands out for them is the overwhelming meaning of that stimulus. While they're doing this Stroop test, in between those trials, there is a subliminal stimulus, either the Hebrew word for being loved, or a positive word that's not attachment-oriented, like success, or a neutral word, hat. Mainly, I want to show you this interaction. What happens is that the amount of time it takes them to name the color is higher for the PTSD group than the low PTSD group, unless they get this security priming. And when you do that, their reaction times for those Hamas and car bomb come down to the level of the low scorers. So something about this comforting circuitry activated by it causes a reduction in this automatic response to the terrorist words. So the final piece of evidence here, I'll say very quickly, Of course, these experiments are very brief, and we assume from other kinds of studies using priming like that the effect is there and then declines, they go back to normal life and everything returns. So we did one pilot experiment. It's the first thing we've tried like this, where the participants came in three times a week, and they were looking at things on a screen and getting these various kinds of subliminal security things, the names of their attachment figures, words love, hug, close, and things like that. And they're doing this over and over during a three-week period. And I'm showing you the results for a particular positive emotion scale that Richie, I think, is using in his report. I chose this one because he said this summer he's going to use it. So this is an example. The person is saying how much they have been feeling interested, excited, and a number of other positive emotion words, and you get a score for this positive mood or feeling state. And this is just what I want to show you, that over the 3 weeks that they're getting this three times a week subliminal stimulation with security, their mood goes up. And then the experiment stops at week three, and a week later, nothing else having happened between, we measure them again, and the difference is sustained. Yeah, so it's a sign, you know, maybe that we could do something like this. So when I have been reading just over the last few months after I agreed to come here, I started reading all these Buddhism books and sort of looking at the concepts and the practice of meditation and so on. And also Matthieu Ricard told me at a party at Paul Ekman's house that using your mother, you know, thinking of how your mother loved you is a traditional Buddhist meditation technique to enhance compassion. So that seems exactly like the logic of our studies, even though we didn't know that when we were doing them. So just with all of that in mind, I noticed this, I take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, and that notion of taking refuge has this, you know, the flavor of attachment theory. A second issue is that the word that's used, that the attachment word that means grasping, that kind of thing, is very much like anxious attachment. You could look at every one of the findings that we have, and it's hundreds. All of them are, I'm insecure, and I wish I could coerce you into solving that problem or something. And so I imagine, I skipped over the brain slides, but I do have one brain study now showing that the more anxious they are on that scale, when we ask them to think about losses and breakups, they get much more emotional than the secure avoidant ones do, and they can't shut it off. They can't down regulate. We then say stop thinking about it, and the secure and avoidant ones show down regulation, and the anxious ones don't. So I think everything that's said in that Buddhist literature about grasping is very similar to that concept. On the other side, the avoidance, I don't see as much about it, but I might just not have read the right things. This notion of defending against grasping, in a way, and unfortunately, I mean, that would be okay if you could do that and nothing bad happened, but in here, the avoidant version of that we've shown is repeatedly related to selfishness, cynicism, lack of compassion, lack of generous motives in social situations. Another issue that I would be happy to talk about this afternoon and learn more about is that the American books about meditation mostly are individually oriented. So when I read it, it's like I could sit home, you know, in my office at my house and do this whole kind of thing, and except for things where what I'm thinking about is compassion, it seems to be mostly about me. It makes it seem like I'll down-regulate my anxiety, my blood pressure will go down, all those good things. But then I notice in the wider context, like right around here where we are this week, there's this supportive community with similar beliefs and kindness toward each other and everything. And I think that's really important because the ability to sustain security is going to be better if it's promoted in a wider group and not just held up by the individual.
Phil, if I could add one very brief point.
Yeah, that's it.
That's why one takes refuge in the Sangha.
Yeah. Good.
Your Holiness, this afternoon we will again divide the session. The first part of the session we will spend discussing some issues that emerged from Phil's presentation this morning. And in the second part, Dr. Murakami from Japan will be giving a short presentation on some novel research that he has done on the effects of laughter. So to begin, we heard from Phil this morning about the importance of security and the role that a secure attachment in Western psychological terms plays in promoting positive emotions, in cultivating compassion, in increasing altruistic behavior. And the results that Phil shared with us are based upon a view that emerged from ethology. Ethology is the study of animal behavior in its natural habitat. What we wanted to start with is to ask Your Holiness to perhaps give us your perspective on Buddhist views for enhancing security, for taking refuge. Also, it seems apparent that Buddhist and Tibetan child-rearing practices may be helpful to us as Western scientists in determining ways to foster increased security. There are some Western clinicians who are using certain concepts from Buddhism to do this, such as Tara Goleman, who's here, and John Kabat-Zinn. Those are examples of Western clinicians who are using ideas derived from Buddhism to promote security and reduce anxiety. But we would be very interested in if you can expand upon this and provide some advice that we may actually be able to incorporate in our research and in our practice to help with this.
As someone was saying that he cannot say something that is very definite. The phenomenon of seeking refuge is actually kind of modeled upon something that is very naturally occurring in human beings, because our natural instinct when we are faced with a threat is to really seek a kind of a safe haven, seek kind of a protection. And because of this, we find similar practices of seeking, you know, consciously seeking refuge, not just in Buddhism, but also in other traditional religious practices as well.
So